This week in the studio, part one of the Fanniversary Exploration of Electric Ladyland by Jimi Hendrix, with his recording engineer Eddie Kramer, his biographer and reissue producer John McDermott, and my interviews with Hendrix drummer the late Mitch Mitchell.
We could be stuck out in the boondocks in Virginia or anywhere, come back to the hotel after the gig, and Jimmy would say, hey, do you want to come out later? Why? He said, like, I know this guitarist down the road in this little roadhouse, you know, and it would be someone like Roy Buchanan or whatever. Remarkable. I mean, the music never ended with that man. This is Mitch Mitchell of the Jimi Hendrix Experience in the studio for the making of Electric Ladyland. Make love to you.
By spring 1968, Jimi Hendrix had returned triumphantly to the U.S. from London after 15 months, having electrified the rock and roll world with two smash albums, the revolutionary debut Are You Experienced and Axis Bold as Love. Hendrix was recording their third, Electric Ladyland, but this time in New York City, with his English trio, the Jimi Hendrix Experience, made up of guitarist-turned-bass player Noel Redding and drummer Mitch Mitchell, and it was all being creatively organized by veteran English musician Chaz Chandler of the Animals. It was Chandler who had given up pop stardom of his own in the Animals after discovering Hendrix struggling in New York's Greenwich Village a scant 2 years earlier. Wagered everything, took Jimmy to London, put a band together for him, financed the project out of his own pocket, and mentored Jimi Hendrix through those first two groundbreaking albums. But practically everything about this third effort would be different. Electric Ladyland, for starters, was double in size. The album covers, yep, there were several, and they were controversial. The album covers looked different than either Are You Experienced or Axis. Electric Ladyland's sound was more muscular, it was earthier, it was bluesier at times, less psychedelic, more American. Jimi Hendrix biographer and executive producer of the entire Experience Hendrix Archive reissue series, John McDermott, sets the table for the banquet that is served up on Electric Ladyland.
Well, creating this deluxe edition of Electric Ladyland was obviously really important to us. And there are a number of reasons, and I think, you know, because of the way Jimmy recorded, he had been denied the opportunity to record as a sideman for the Isley Brothers and Little Richard and others. You know, every now and then he'd get in the studio for a little bit. But it was Chaz Chandler who gave him the gift of opportunity and took him to England and, you know, brought him into a proper studio and finally let him start to articulate his talent. What's great about Electric Ladyland is that it's Jimmy's record. His thumbprint is on every aspect of it. We've worked really hard in the years, you know, these last 25 years to present to his fans, like, here are some of the directions he was going in, some of the musicians he was playing in, some of the ideas that were really fertile but yet, you know, may not have been fully formed. Electric Ladyland, that's fully formed. This is his, from the artwork, songwriting, layout and design, everything. And that's what makes it so exciting. When you kind of take a step back, you realize, just as you said, the impact that it has. Whether you heard it in 1968 or whether you're hearing it in 2018, it packs a wallop. It has not diminished one bit. If anything, people recognize it for the chances it took, for the diversity that it presents. It's the definitive Jimi Hendrix statement. It just shows you what it could have been had he, you know, sadly not passed in 1970. There would have been a string of these that, you know, I think and many others think would have changed American world popular culture.
across your back. I can see you had your fun, but darling, can't you see my signals turn from green to red? And with you, I can see a traffic jam straight up ahead. You're just like so hard to get through to you.
From the autumn 1968 double album by the Jimi Hendrix Experience called Electric Ladyland, that's Crosstown Traffic. Chaz Chandler had discovered Jimi Hendrix while Chaz was the bass player of the popular English blue-collar band The Animals. Yet Chaz walked away from The Animals to manage and produce this total unknown named Jimi Hendrix. With the 1967 Jimi Hendrix Experience debut album called Are You Experienced? Followed by Axis, Bold as Love, those two Chandler-produced albums revolutionized music to this day. Here's Hendrix biographer John McDermott.
By the time you get to Electric Ladyland, the third album, it's really Jimmy having graduated from that education that Chaz provided him. I think he saw that he had made two very successful albums based on short, compact songs, kind of in that Chandler mindset. And I think he had an idea with Electric Ladyland for kind of this more sprawling, all-encompassing album that would, you know, blend what he at that time was considering a new type of blues music along with other influences that he had, all in one package. The technological change in America, with the record plant being a 12-track studio, fascinated him. And I think Chaz was a little too inflexible early on and didn't give Hendrix the time to kind of experiment with maybe involving, you know, additional overdubs or mixing techniques or things of that nature. I think he just said, you know, look, let's get the songs, let's get in there, let's do it, let's move forward. And I think Jimmy really felt, well, he had done that and now was the time to take it to the next level. And that was, I think, one of the primary sources of tension between the two guys. That being said, at the end of the day, one of the reasons why Electric Ladyland is so successful is that it's almost the perfect marriage of the Chandler technique and really focused compact songs like Crosstown Traffic, All on the Watchtower, coupled with these beautiful expansive tracks like 1983 and Rainy Day Dream Away and the long blues Voodoo Child, which were really more in keeping with what Hendrix also wanted to include. So you got the best of both worlds.
Some complications would develop during recording Electric Ladyland in 1968. Hendrix, an American, shifted his all-British band, all-British management, producer, engineer, and recording team to a stateside base. And a booking agent, Michael Jeffrey, would share the role of business manager previously occupied solely by Hendrix's mentor, Chaz Chandler. It was starting to get crowded in the Hendrix horse race, and the field was all jockeying for position. In his final National American Radio interview, then dying after performing on an Experience Hendrix tour in 2008, here is Jimi Hendrix drummer Mitch Mitchell in the studio.
Jimmy decided really that we just started to spend a lot more time in New York. It was the first, you know, Jimmy actually got an apartment there eventually. It was still like lunacy, really. I was living in motels, hotels. Mike Jeffries, the other manager, was appearing more readily on the scene. I mean, Chaz Chandler had gone out on the road with us quite a lot, was always there, had always done the studio situations. We came across an engineer called Gary Kellegrin, who had this little studio, Mayfair, in Times Square, and we did a track, The Burning of the Midnight Lamp, there. Tiny little studio, but we liked his work, and not long after that, he opened the first of a couple of studios, The Record Plant, which happened to be something, I think it was 48th Street, New York, Now, we were booked in from 9 o'clock at night until about, say, 4 in the morning. Traffic with Steve Winwood, they were in the studio directly before us from the afternoon. There was a club around the corner called The Scene on 46th Street where everyone, the world and his wife, went to have a jam session. And that led to a lot of musicians just coming straight back from the club straight to the studio. I mean, it was absolute lunacy to the point of there was like limousines on hold for like 24 hours a day just to drive 2 blocks. It was just ridiculous. And Chaz was hating it because he'd been brought up with getting things done very quickly in the studio. I mean, he never let us forget, rightfully so, that like House of the Rising Sun cost $10 to make and was done in 30 minutes. Whereas, you know, I mean, that was all done with Mickey Most, and that's the way producers used to work. The first albums with Chaz, things were done very quickly, very quickly, you know. Jimmy loved being in the studio, and, you know, I mean, he just would live there, given the choice, and he did, basically. And that was getting on Chaz's nerves as well.
People talking, but they just don't know what's in my heart and why I love you so. I love you, baby, like a mine of love gold. Come on, sugar, let the good time roll. Hey! People live and make believe. They keep a lot of dirt up their sleeve. But my love, baby, isn't the kind that fools. Come on, baby, let the good times roll. Hey. If it's understood, it's even nicer when you're feeling good. You got me flipping like a flag on a pole. Come on, sugar, let the good time roll. Hey! Oh, let the good time roll. We'll be right back.
fun rave up by Earl King, one of two covers by Jimi Hendrix on Electric Ladyland Deluxe Edition, available as a 3-CD plus Blu-ray or a 6-vinyl LP plus Blu-ray set, both including the original Electric Ladyland double album, newly remastered, and the long-awaited 5.1 surround sound. Up next, a stunning find in the demo tape stored away after 50 years. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the Jimi Hendrix Experience Electric Ladyland Part 1. Jimi Hendrix Experience Electric Ladyland. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with my archival interview with Hendrix drummer Mitch Mitchell, who reminded us that Hendrix was a Seattle native who had his career launched from London by an English manager-producer with two band members who were English as well. Returning to New York City in 1968 as a big star when he had left as a lowly sideman on the Chitlin' circuit was a huge personal victory for a young Jimmy, and who could blame him for wanting to bask in being a local hero back in the homeland? Yet everyone else in Hendrix's inner circle were not home and wanted to be. The late experienced drummer Mitch Mitchell explains.
He was changing. I mean, I suppose there must have been a degree of, I can't say local boy makes good, but I mean, to go back to live in New York comfortably and have access to all kinds of musicians and everything else in the space of a couple of years, when you left New York, you know, you're scrabbling to get a gig in the village, and you know, now you're back and you can have more or less what you want. I mean, I'm not saying it went to a young man's head, but of course it's bound to a degree, and it just has to. And it was, I know it used to really piss off Noel. And even myself, I mean, I love studios. Either people do or they don't. It's one of those things. So I never had any problem spending an hour after hour in a studio, no sweat at all. But, you know, we go back to England for a few days here and there to get a haircut or to go to a club speakeasy, that kind of thing. But it did start to wear a bit thin, and especially with Chaz.
All right. I am sweet gone. My gypsy eyes is burning, and I've been singing. Oh, I've been singing.
Amidst all of Jimi Hendrix's meteoric rise to stardom in barely 18 months and only two albums, there were huge obstacles to his success, both inside and outside the band. For instance, the bass player in The Experience, Englishman Noel Redding, who passed away May 2003. Noel was a converted guitar player who was previously earmarked for duty in The Animals. That's the band Jimi Hendrix's producer, manager Chaz Chandler, had found pop success in. So according to Experience drummer Mitch Mitchell, the one musician with whom Jimi Hendrix played more than any other, by the time they started recording Electric Ladyland, it made Jimmy's relationship with his own bass player, Noel Redding, increasingly awkward.
I mean, Noel was a more than competent guitarist, but he was a bass owner. Bass guitar was never, wasn't particularly an instrument that he loved. I'm not speaking ill of people that passed away, but he didn't know who Jerry Jamont, or, you know, he didn't know the Motown players, or whereas Jimmy did. So, I mean, a lot of the things Jimmy and I worked out between, I looked to Jimmy as the bass player. Jimmy played bass on quite a few of the records. Or he told Noel what to play, which was always a bone of contention, unfortunately. Because I do rely on bass to a giant degree, and you do in a trio format. Especially in my role with Jimmy, where I had an immense amount of freedom to throw ideas at Jimmy and likewise, back and forth. So we were very reliant on Noel, and he did an extremely good job of holding down what, just to, you know, to keep a pulse of some description down there. I've got to say, when Billy Cox came in the later years, it made my life as a drummer a lot easier. He was a bass heel. He is a bass player, not a bass owner. And there is a heck of a difference there. Of course, the other thing being in the early days doing live shows, guitar and bass, they had the big Marshall amplifier, the big stacks, whereas the PA systems for the voice and the drums would go through were like nothing at all. I mean, there were no like side monitors for the, no wedges for the drums for any feedback at all. I mean, you had to look at the guitarist's hands a lot of the time and more or less hope that you were playing in the same rhythm. I mean, in the end, I ended up getting a huge Voice of the Theatre PA system just for the drums. So I had some control over what was going on. I mean, for monitors, but there were no monitors. Monitors didn't exist.
Angel come down from heaven yesterday. She stayed with me just long enough for afternoon tea. And she tell me a story yesterday about the love between the moon and the deep blue sea. And when it was time for her to go, she spread her wings high over me. And she said, I shall return tomorrow. And I said, fly on, my sweet angel. Fly on through the sky. Fly on, my sweet angel. Tomorrow I'll look for you by my side.
sure enough, this morning comes to me with silver wings silhouette against the glow of the child's sunrise. And as the bluebirds and the sparrows envy me, she says, I love you, little boy, and today you shall fly. She kissed me once, and the feeling so good, she made me cry. And now we can fly together.
Wow, what a discovery after 50 years to find that one of my favorite Hendrix songs, Angel, released immediately after his death on the album Cry of Love, actually was written 2 years earlier during the Electric Ladyland batch. Here is executive producer John McDermott.
Well, one of the interesting things with Angel is it started as Sweet Angel, and I think with the development, it's kind of mirrored Little Wing. They're written around the same time, in that Axis Bold is Love album period. There's a great demo of Sweet Angel, as it was first known. And we put that out on the Purple Jimi Hendrix Experience box set. And it just shows how Jimmy had a vision for that song. I mean, used to, at the time, was known as a rhythm ace, which was an early drum machine, just because it was him alone in the studio with Eddie Kramer, and he wanted to get this idea down. Then later, we have versions where you have glockenspiel, you've got Mitch playing with him, you have Jimmy actually getting behind the drums to kind of show Mitch exactly the feel that he wanted. So I was really surprised when it didn't show up on Electric Ladyland. It's such a brilliant song, and it seemed like it would fit perfectly on the record. But, you know, this is the great mystery with all things Jimi Hendrix. Without him here to say what he was thinking, we don't know. But it became a song when Electric Lady Studios opened in 1970 that he recorded again from scratch with Mitch and Billy Cox. So he understood the value of the song, but for whatever reason, he couldn't get his arms around whether it was the arrangement, the lyrics, you know, what he wanted to bring to the song. And I think that's it just shows you that some of these songs had a long tail for Jimmy. You know, they were ideas that might have come from 67 and may not have taken full form until 3 years later. Had he lived, it might have been 5 years later. My Friend was a great example of that as well. I mean, that was something that a song that would be perfect for Electric Ladyland. And again, it wasn't. He just kept it and later was on Cry of Love. When Electric Lady Studios was opening, Jimmy brought that tape out, played it for Eddie Kramer, who wasn't the engineer in the session. He's like, you know, this is a really good one. And they put it aside. It was like, okay, this could be on the next record. So, you know, he thought about his songs from his vantage point and his perspective. It really wasn't, okay, I finished this song, that's one, now I'm going to go to the other. He didn't really work in that way. Many of his songs he would go back to, change the arrangements, change the lyrics, try, you know, Buddy Miles and Billy Cox on bass and drums instead of Mitch and Noel. Yeah, I guess that was the kind of the producer in him, the visionary who wanted to see where it could go until it reached that level of satisfaction where he said, yeah, that's going to go on the record.
Still to come, John McDermott returns to document the changes that Jimi Hendrix was experiencing at this time in 1968. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Red Beard. You're in the studio. The Jimi Hendrix Experience, Electric Ladyland, Part 1. Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard. There's a notorious story about the very earliest days, pre-stardom, of the Jimi Hendrix Experience when they were booked on a pop tour opening for The Monkees, a manufactured made-for-TV group. But as a matter of fact, The experienced band members were chosen by Jimmy's English manager, Chaz Chandler, not by Hendrix, as biographer John McDermott reminds us.
You know, one of the interesting things about the Jimi Hendrix experience is that, you know, these guys didn't go to high school together or all in the van together. Hey, we're going to form a band. You know, I mean, they were effectively, by happenstance, they lucked out into Mitch and lucked out into Noel, who were two really great musicians. But Noel was a guitar player who played bass to get the gig. And I think it was hard for him, particularly when Chaz Chandler left the project, to be patient enough with Jimmy to develop these songs in the studio. I think, you know, now when we think about an artist creating a record, you know, that everything is possible. There's an, you know, infinity of tracks, plenty of time. But back then there was this kind of musical chairs thing where you wanted to get all this thing done because they might take it away. I mean, a year and a half before, Jimi Hendrix was starving in Greenwich Village with nothing going on. By the time of Electric Ladyland, I mean, he was finally getting a chance to really be in a first-rate studio, both at Olympic in London and then the record plant in New York, a supportive engineer around him, great musicians around him, friends that he finally was able to bring in, whether it was Jack Cassidy, Steve Winwood, Al Cooper, any of the people who played on the record. I think what he was trying to do was use the studio not only as a place to record, but as a place to develop material. So it's the emergence of Jimi Hendrix as a producer, recognizing that, okay, you know what? I actually think I could take it this way. And no one was there to say, hey, Jim, I don't know about that. There was no A&R person. There was no record label person. I mean, he literally was like, okay, I'm going to bring Jack Cassidy and Steve Winwood in, Mitch in, and we're going to rehearse this thing, and then bang, we're going to record it, and Eddie will record it right here live in the studio. And that turns out to be Voodoo Child, the long blues song, and one of the greatest performances in rock history. But it comes out of, you know, Jimmy having a vision and having the ability to kind of take everybody back from the scene club to the record plant and record this incredible song.
The late drummer Mitch Mitchell tells about the falling out between Hendrix and his mentor, Chaz Chandler, at this time, the shift from London to New York City for the band, and the opening for financial guy Michael Jeffrey to move into sole manager role.
Anyway, the friction was getting there with Chaz and Jimmy. Jimmy decided that he wanted to live in America. And so the ties with the old country, with Britain, were going out the window as regards having that as a base. Anything that we were doing from then on was going to be done from an office in the States. And to the point that Michael Jeffries was making his power play behind the scenes there. You know, he was an equal partner with Chaz on a financial level, but we didn't actually see him at all. We saw him a couple of times a year for the first couple of years. And then he was setting up his offices in New York, and changes were going down, you know, some good, some bad. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of craziness during the Electric Lady sessions. I mean, there was no security at the record plant studio. The World and his wife were going in there flopping. You know, I mean, it was just a load of hangers-on, liggers, which really did get very annoying. There were some good things. I mean, like people like Linda Eastman, Linda McCartney, she was always coming around. I mean, we had our family and our friends there as well. And she got some good photos out of that. And things like, because Stevie Winwood was around, you know, we got him to play in a couple of sessions. Jack Cassidy, your bass player friend of mine from the Airplane, he was around the corner at the scene club. Come on, Jack, let's go back to the studio, you know. So 4 o'clock in the morning, we actually did get some things down.
I'm a voodoo child. Lord, I'm a voodoo child.
Thank you. swear the moon turned a fire red.
Thank you. away is Jupiter soft and mild. Say my heroes are made of desire. From far away is Jupiter soft and mild. Way down by the Midland Sea. Have a hummingbird and it hums so loud. You think you are losing your mind.
One great thing that was a great relaxation with Jimmy and with for myself, we could be stuck out in the boondocks in Virginia or anywhere, come back to the hotel after the gig, and Jimmy would say, hey, do you want to go out later? Why? He said, like, I know this guitarist down the road in this little roadhouse, you know, and it would be someone like Roy Buchanan or whatever. So many things like that occurred that I would not have had the chance to in my life if it hadn't been for knowing and being a friend with Jimmy. He took me to the first South Side in Chicago for the blues clubs, you know. Remarkable. I mean, the music never ended with that man, and that was the beauty of it.
Child.
one of the most powerful live in the studio recordings ever, with Steve Winwood on organ, Jack Cassidy of the Jefferson Airplane on atomic bass, and Mitch Mitchell on drums, with Jimi Hendrix on guitar and vocal. It's all included in the Making Of documentary, unreleased demos, alternate takes, and an unreleased live Hollywood Bowl concert. In the Jimi Hendrix Experience Electric Ladyland Anniversary Deluxe Edition, it's now available as a 3-CD plus Blu-ray or a 6-vinyl LP plus Blu-ray. I'm Redbeard. Details about part 2 of our special rockumentary in the studio after this.